Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake McClure. We ended on a cliffhanger. Are we going to have a recession? I said September. At the current rate of spending, we are going to be at pre-pandemic levels in the bank in September. The big question is, will we stop spending at a high rate before then? And the only way to answer that is to think about it for yourself. Will you? If you get back to what you had in the bank in 2019, most of us have more in the bank today than we did in 2019. If you get down to that level, are you going to be stopping before you get down to what you had then? And it's a big question. So people can make all these educated swags at it. The wag part of the swag is the scientific, and if you've ever been around donkeys, you know that wild asses are not always consistent in their directions. So even with a scientific guess at this, it's still going to be up to the rest of us wild asses in how we spend our money and what happens when we start to get down. So our economy, barring some growth from other things, may clearly slow down sometime this year. And that would be considered a recession. Now, as we said last hour, we've got lots of jobs and lots of extra cash in the bank. And that cash in the bank is what's sustaining us right now. Why is it that we're not having normal growth other than this extra spending? And it's because the rest of the world, which usually helps support us by buying things from us, is slowing down their purchasing. They are not buying as much. Our dollar is getting strong, so our things are more expensive to them. It's easier for us to buy from them, so we're supporting their nations quite a lot. The money that we're sending to them, because we have better prices on that money, is allowing them to not be as far into recession. That is about as clear as I can get on that. So coming, it's not clear in any way. We can say, okay, the spending is going to get slower sometime this year, barring a bunch of extra influx of money from other sources. We're going to start running out of money to spend, or at least feel uncomfortable spending the money that we have. If prices start to drop, because China's just opened up on its manufacturing, we may actually slow down our spending early. Those are things that could happen. We could avoid a recession completely because China opens up, starts manufacturing, the prices drop in Germany and across Europe, so they're able to buy stuff without tremendous inflation. The stuff going on in Ukraine calms down. All that stuff could cause us to completely skip a recession. Or we could skip a recession just because we managed to have enough in our banks to make it through the pinch point. Other countries are in recession, right? So what does that mean? If we go into recession, what does it mean? Well, that's generally recognized as having some major unemployment issues, that we have a much higher unemployment than we would have today. Our unemployment today is 3.5%, which is new news. That 3.5% is it's clearly low. It's historically extremely low.
Thing is, you asked, and it all came from the question, are we going to have a recession in the next 18 months? 18 months is a long time. It's entirely possible that in 2024, things could evolve into a natural recession. I will say something about this time period we're in. We are in pretty much uncharted water. Several things just occurred. As a matter of fact, one of the things occurred yesterday that last occurred 100 years ago, or recently occurred. The last time we failed to elect a Speaker of the House on the first ballot with a new Congress was in 1923. And here it is, 2023. Is that a coincidence? I don't think so. We had a series of economic events that occurred at the beginning of the 20th century, rotating around a war that was a kind of a messy, sloppy war in which a lot of Americans got killed, and Americans were generally not real happy about the outcome of the war. We called it World War I then, and we called it whatever Iraq and Afghanistan was this time. We had a pandemic. We called it the Spanish flu, or the 1918 flu, or something like that in the last century. We called it the Spanish flu when in the first place it occurred in a widespread fashion was at Fort Riley, Kansas, but we blamed it on the Spanish. Well, I still haven't figured that one out.
That's what you do with diseases. It's really a lot easier if you can blame it on a group of people than on viruses. It's really hard to find the viruses to blame them, specifically historically. It's really easy to say, oh, it's those Spanish people again.
We didn't name viruses back then. The COVID-19 is the name of a virus. So anyway.
It's not even the official name. It's just our slang name.
Right. But it's name. Nickname. The other thing that's happening is following the pandemic, we had a series of economic upheavals and surges back and forth. Unfortunately, we didn't measure economic activity in the United States very accurately or very well or very consistently in the 1920s. As a matter of fact, the new Secretary of Commerce that came in the 1920s, a guy named Herbert Hoover, who some of you may have heard of, was the guy who put engineering and statistics into the Commerce Department and created the Bureau of Economic Analysis and said, we need to measure this stuff and try to figure out what's going on. So we don't have good records.
Didn't he do vacuum cleaners too? Oh, no. He does a different.
Hoover. Well, he did a damn.
Yeah.
So he gave a damn about things.
Yes, he did. Majorly.
The point I'm making here is that about 100 years ago, this same set of economic events occurred, but we don't have good records on it. And we're going through them again. From all we can tell from what we did have, they are amazingly similar. But the issue is we don't have good enough records to say this is what's happening for sure. So what we can say pretty clearly is for 100 years, we have not seen this series of economic events. It's very different. It's very unusual. We're largely in uncharted water. Somebody sailed here before, but they sailed in an ancient sailing ship, and we're in a relatively modern ship cruising along at a much higher speed. But I can say that we probably, as a result, there's no certainty here about the future, are entering into the Roaring 20s. Because the Roaring 20s really didn't get started until about 1923. And 24. And we're headed there pretty fast. Our economy is so amazingly healthy at this point. We have still excess cash reserves. And by the way, there's a lot of estimates on when the excess reserves will be spent down. Excess reserves, by the way, don't just count the money that's in bank and money market funds. It also counts how much credit people have on their credit cards that historically they have used, particularly the lower income people, tend to use the available credit on their credit cards until it hits about 70 or 80% of the possible they can use, and then they start to level off. Well, we're not even close to that at this point. So my feeling, and it is just a gut feeling, is that we'll probably go through 2023 in good shape with things moderating. What happens in 2024? Well, there's too much that could happen between now and then that is random to even make a guess at what happens in 2024. I will, though, say I think this decade will be one of very significant technological change and economic growth. I know I'm going on and on. Can I give one more thing here?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
It's good stuff.
Read a really interesting article yesterday about the fact that we may very well actually have those self-driving cars we've been promised, and it won't be from Tesla. There is an Israeli company that was actually spun off from Microsoft that is making tremendous strides in artificial intelligence driving. They have, and they won't say who is using their technology. They are really secretive about it, but they have apparently test vehicles on the roads right now. This is the position they're taking. It is a no hands, eyes on condition. In other words, they have test vehicles driving in the United States right now where there's a driver in the vehicle, but the driver does not have his or her hands on the steering wheel all across the country driving in bad weather, and they are refining this, and it looks like they are making some very significant progress. And we really could have those self-driving vehicles that we've been talking about in the not-too-far-distant future. That will make a huge difference. And the difference, again, is a parallel. And a lot of people are not aware of this. You have to actually dig to find this. But it was in the 1920s that the United States made the transition from horsepower to internal combustion engine power. We started before the 1920s, but going into World War One, I will tell you, there were a lot of military transport items moved around at the beginning or during the prior to 1920 that were pulled by horses. And they were kind of at the cutting edge of technology at that point, the militaries were. And in the 1920s is when we made the transition from horsepower to gasoline engine power. And we're making a transition right now to electric power and artificial intelligence. And I think by the end of the decade, we will have seen such a tremendous technological boom in so many areas, in so many ways, and there'll be so much wealth accumulated that even if we have a recession in 2023 or 24, it'll be so mild that it'll be a recession that's on the books, but not in the pocketbooks. That is my opinion. The one thing that I can say that might throw that off is it's almost a sure thing that most of the rest of the world will be in recession in 2023.
Yeah.
And they buy a lot of stuff from us. And as a result, they won't be buying as much stuff from us. So that'll hurt us.
I agree. And
long answer to a simple question.
Yeah. So laying it out, it's pretty clear from the leading economic indicators. There's another piece to the puzzle that I want to throw in here too. People spend differently when their house price is going up than when their house price is going down. Why is that? Because houses are not money. In case any of you are confused about this, houses are not money. It's really, really hard to buy groceries with your house. You can sell your house and buy groceries, but your house will not buy groceries on its own. I mean, it's not money. But for some reason, this is part of the reason last year when we were talking about the boffins that were worried about the rental value of a house that isn't being rented and why we consider that part of inflation. Because people tend to spend more when their house value goes up. They may not have more money in the bank, but when they feel like their house is worth more money, they spend more. So what's happening in the housing market right now? And the housing market is in decline. It is lower than it was. It's year over year, it's down. What does that mean? It means people who have felt euphoric over the price of their house and felt comfortable spending a little extra are going to start to think a little differently about it. Now, it's probably not going to hit all at once, or maybe not hit at all, because the downturn in prices is very small at this point from a year ago. Now, when we get to April, we may see that the downturn in prices are slightly more, because in April of last year, that was the peak of the housing prices, where the houses were the highest. So in April of this year, even if they don't move down anymore, it's going to look like we had a greater decline. That's the whole annualized thing we were talking about. So it's going to look in April like we had a greater decline in the value of houses, even though if you weren't selling your house, it's still your house. The value is irrelevant. People still change the way they spend based on that data. And so we can expect that to be a factor on how quickly people are spending in the future. Savings are coming down. Credit card loans are moving up in balance. And these are all things that we're using to fuel our economy right now. So I would say a greater than 70% chance in the 18 months coming that we have a recession. I went out on a limb and I actually said it. I would say we could completely skip it as well. And that's that 30% chance. Just looking around, we're due one. We're actually really due a recession, and recessions are kind of good for us long term. It's not fun when they happen, don't get me wrong, but it's that old saying, you don't know who's not wearing swimming trunks till the tide goes out. This is the time that we catch the scam artists that are selling stuff that aren't profitable that they've been claiming there are. When we see stuff like the crypto collapse Bernie Madoff didn't get caught until we had a collapse. We required a collapse in order to need to take money out of this mythically amazing. Why would you take money out of a portfolio that was making money all the time? It's just growing into astronomically large numbers. Why would you take money out of it? Well, because other assets dropped and you needed to make up the difference. You needed to make the ends meet. So you grabbed from the place that was doing well, only it really wasn't. This is how we catch scam artists. It's how we know when a business that's not profitable but is claiming it's going to be, and then we find out there's really never a way for them to get to profitability. So this is when we collect this stuff. We've been about 10 years without a slowdown enough, and when you look at it more directly, it's been about 15 years since we've had an honest-to-goodness recession. The recession that we had at the beginning of the pandemic doesn't really count because it was so not the normal recession. You didn't have time to retool and rethink because everybody was sitting at home and not able to work together. We were figuring out ways to do that. The recession that almost didn't happen because the money came in from the federal government and from the Federal Reserve and from all the different places under two administrations coming together to fund the stimuli that caused us to not have a long recession right then. And other people on the planet had a long recession at that point. So now we've come forward to now, and that excess money that was granted to us then is part of the reason why, a very small part, of the reason, but a part of the reason why we're having inflation, but a major part of why we are not in recession right now while Germany is moving into it and China very likely is in recession. There. That was my attempt at smearing the window enough that you could see through it, but it's still smeared.
Well, it's
nobody can see through it.
It's clear as mud, but it covers the ground.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about the Secure 2.0, which
There's a lot to Secure 2.0. And Secure 2.0, by the way, as Jake very carefully pointed out to me yesterday, and it's certainly true, is not a law. It's part of the omnibus. And if you've never been on an omnibus, you really don't understand how confusing that can be.
Yeah.
But there's some significant changes there. If you turn 72 in 2023, boy, that's a lot of numbers, then you don't have to take your RMD in 2023.
The required minimum distribution from a retirement plan. So let's take a step back a second, because otherwise we're just going to be spouting gibberish and acronyms for a few minutes. Let's go back to what is a traditional 401k and an IRA? Well, you put money in it and the government says, hey, you don't have to pay taxes on this money as long as you meet all these criteria. You put the money in there. And when you take it out, you can pay the taxes then. But you don't have to pay the taxes now. I'm grossly oversimplifying because there's lots and lots of age signifiers, income signifiers, whether or not you have workplace plan and IRA plan and your income's above a certain, all that stuff. And that changes year to year. So there's a lot of complexity there. But the basic underlying concept is on the traditional side of the workplace plan or an IRA, not the Roth side, you're not paying any taxes right now. You'll pay them later. Well, Congress is like, well, that's good. Then all the growth that you get on all that money, you're going to pay taxes on that too, and we'll get this revenue in the future. Well, the future has to be set. They have to say this is the age that the future is when you're finally going to get to pay us the taxes that you haven't paid us yet. One of the issues in trying to read an omnibus bill is you get spending and revenue in the same law, and it's very convoluted, so you have to look back and forth. Anyway, when you take the money out, Congress finally gets their revenue. And there's been a push. It was a few years back in 2018 and before. If you were 70 and a half, the year in which you turned 70 and a half, you had to take money out before the end of the following year. That sounds like an SAT question of some kind. 70 and a half, who does that? Well, we still say 59 and a half is the retirement age. So five-year-olds are in Congress. I have a three-and-a-half-year-old here, and he's very proud of the fact that he's three and a half. Congress thinks 59 and a half, and it used to think 70 and a half were important. Well, now it doesn't so much. It said In 2019, Secure Act was passed, and they said, hey, we're going to raise the required distribution age from 70 and a half to 72. And we all said, oh, that's nice. You can leave it in your portfolio if you're still working or you don't need to touch it. You don't have to mess with it. Well, now they've moved it up to 73. So if you turned 72 last year, you're going to still do it this year because you're 73 this year. But if you're turning 72 this year, it's going to skip you. There's no fairness here, by the way. It's just a rolling number. My older brother, when we were teenagers, was just a few years away from drinking age in Texas when they moved the drinking age year by year from 18 to 21. They said it was 19, and then it was 20, and then it was 21. And he was just a few years away from drinking age for like 5 years. So this is sort of what's happening to your required minimum distribution all the way out to 2033. Over the next 10 years, it's going to get raised up to 75 there.
It just jumps to 75 in 2033. But the interesting thing about this, it's the tax law, folks, and they pass one every year, which means next year they can change it. So don't get too excited about it one way or the other.
But all of us get to spend hours and hours memorizing things that we may have to unmemorize immediately. Yes.
Another thing that is maybe have an impact on some folks is that if you have a 529 plan and it's at least 15 years old, it can be rolled into a Roth IRA, which wasn't possible before. Now, the income limitations to open a Roth IRA remain in place. So if you're very, very high income, you still can't roll it into a Roth IRA. Although somebody, if they didn't write this very succinctly and carefully, which they probably didn't, we don't know the details of how this is going to work out yet, somebody may find a way to backdoor the 529 into a Roth IRA by doing something strange.
Right. Right now, it's you can move. You've got to meet all the same contribution requirements. It starts in a few years, so you can't do it right away. There's a lifetime amount that you can do. Can't do more than $35,000 over your whole life. If your income is too high, you can't contribute to a Roth, you can't do it. So there's a lot of qualifiers.
Yeah, but whose Roth does it go into? And I think
the
it goes
beneficiary.
Into the beneficiary's it Roth. Is, but you can change the beneficiary at any point
right.
to another member of your family. So I can see how if you have five members of your family, you could move one-fifth of it into each of them for a 529 and then open up five $35,000 Roth IRAs.
You can't do the whole lifetime in 1 year. Nothing in this simplified anything. There's a lifetime thing. You have to meet the contribution guidelines. This year it's, or 2022 was $6,000. So if you $6,000 in, that met your whole contribution. You can't roll over more than that. You can add up to the 35.
This is my point and looking at it. And again, the details, the devil's in the details here, so it may not work out this way, but I could see a loophole immediately. I have five children. I have a host of grandchildren. I have the capability, if I have a big 529, of dividing it among any of them. So the contribution, when I say divide it, they would become the beneficiaries. And then next year, they each could open a Roth IRA with the 529 money that I gave them. So you could. Now, the nice thing about a Roth IRA from the government's point of view is when you convert that 529 plan to a Roth IRA, income taxes are due on it, but no penalties. So it's an interesting planning device if you have a big 529 that you're not spending. And a lot of people, by the way, are not spending their 529s. That's one of the problems that the government has run into for tax purposes.
Yeah. So this kind of opens the window a little bit. When we talk about an omnibus bill, this thing has $858 billion for defense and $750+ for domestic spending. And you have revenue things in here and changes in the tax code to raise revenue. You have spending that one of the accounts that they have to look at, what is the value in the revenue, potential revenue in this account to the U.S. government? The Congressional Budget Office has to give that a value. So 529 plans are where you put money for college or for higher education of some kind. You put money in there and you don't have to pay taxes on the money that's growing in there. You pay taxes when you put the money in, when you made the money, it goes in there. The growth on it's not taxed and it's never taxed if you use it for school. Well, if you've made it through school and you have money left over in your college fund, and this is a reluctance that a lot of people have. Well, what if they want to spend it on something else? Well, there's a penalty on the gains, not the principal, if your end taxes due on the gains when you take it out for not for school purposes. So what we have found and what a lot of people have found and what the numbers are showing is that people don't tend to liquidate their 529s when they're done with college. They hold on to them and they say, maybe I'll go back to college. When they have kids, they transfer them on to their kids. So the Congressional Budget Office has this imaginary number on someday they'll pay taxes on the gains in here and someday they'll pay a penalty on this. And the number for that is this imaginary number. Well, when Congress says we're going to allow a rollover into a Roth, a bureaucrat in the room says, well, yeah, but that's going to take from revenue. And we have the Balanced Budget Act that was passed under Newt Gingrich that doesn't actually balance the budget. We just have to find an imaginary piece of revenue for the imaginary piece of spending that didn't actually occur, because no spending occurred when you rolled the money from one account to another. But the value of the revenue has to be there. So they have to find it somewhere else in this massive law how to balance out the revenue and the spending, which is why you never have a law that makes any sense. Why it is that, you know, we're raising in a couple of years the catch-up contribution. If you're older than 50 years old, you can put more in your IRA than if you're younger than 50 years old. That's called the catch-up. Maybe I don't have enough in there. I'm getting closer to retirement.
Well, in a raise that, by the way, in Secure 2.0.
Yes, they raise the amount that you can put in. In 2 years, it will increase by 10%. In 3 years, the amount that you put in between the ages of 60 and 63 will move from what had been 7,500, but add 10% to that, to 10,000, but add 10% to the original 7,500. Mm-hmm. At the age of 64... you no longer can put extra money in there. You go back to the same. So between the age of 60 and 63, you can put in the equivalent of $10,000. But then at 64, it goes back to 7,500. But then you've got a 10% increase. You can see where this is convoluted. And it was about, well, if we allow people to put extra money in as catch-up, and in order to qualify for this, if you make more than $145,000, you have to put it into the Roth side of the catch-up. So that means HR at the corporate level is going to have to know what your dual earned income is at home to see if you're above that much, to tell whether or not your extra catch-up can go into the Roth, or it's going to be complicated.
Yeah. To give you an example of complication, I kept reading that in order to get the new Speaker of the House elected, he had to concede to the ultra-conservative Republicans who were holding out that he would cut the defense budget by $75 billion. And I thought, and we discussed that and thought maybe that was aid to Ukraine or something. Turned out it wasn't. What he did actually was promise to cut domestic spending by $75 billion. But the law in place requires that if he cuts domestic spending by $75 billion, we have to cut defense by $75 billion, and it will go across the board. Talking about something that could generate a recession, that would mean in order to cut domestic spending by $75 billion, he has to cut $150 billion out of the budget, which means the United States government would spend $150 billion less. And that has a ripple effect that is earth-shaking across the economy.
About
$500 trillion cut in spending next year.
Yeah, and this is an important factor. We've talked about the GDP is how we measure growth and whether or not you have a recession and so on. Government spending in GDP, for no apparent reason, is considered part of the growth side of the economy. It's not growth, but the algorithm to make GDP says government spending is part of growth, which means if we drop $300 billion or more, even if we go back to just he's cutting 75 here and there, so $150 billion just drops off the GDP. Not that I'm upset about that, but it's going to have a ripple effect. I'm actually okay if they cut back on spending here, but it's going to have a ripple effect. It's going to look like our GDP just dropped.
Well, every dollar that's spent on defense generates about $5 in the GDP, because you spend the dollar to do something, and that causes the company to do something, which because causes something else to
Northrop Grumman's getting loans and L3 and Raytheon and BAE.
So the same ratio occurs in domestic spending. So it's kind of interesting. If you cut $150 billion next year from the next budget, which is what the agreement that the speaker made with the holdouts, it will, you need to multiply that by at least five. So it's well over $500 trillion gets cut out of the spending and out of the GDP and out of the growth of the United States.
And it sounds like we're arguing against the government cutting spending. We're not. We're trying to say these are ripple effects that will occur from a minor discussion on a congressional floor. So these are things that we have to watch. And when we say the GDP and whether or not we're in a real recession, is it real? I don't know. Is it real if government spending drops? Well, it's real as a recession if you're working at BAE and you lose your job. It's not so real to the rest of us that didn't lose a job from it. And that's true of any recession. So we mandatorily have to think things in aggregate. We have to think about the average and throw it all in a bucket and mix it all together, even if it doesn't go together. We have to look at dry ice and boiling water and say, yep, average is fine. The reality is that one is really hot and one is really cold. You have to hold that in place, part of the behavior of the group of people. Like, which part of the economy spends more? The new tech employee or somebody that's 30 years at a corporation? As a percentage of their income, the new tech employee spends a heck of a lot more money. So a tech employee layoff versus somebody near retirement layoff has a very different impact on the economy. You can't forget that in your averages. And that's one of the things that leads to us.
Oh, you can.
Well, yeah, we can. Actually, most people do. And most people don't even know that they're forgetting because they never knew to forget it.
That is certainly true.
Yeah. And so when you're measuring this stuff, it's like good cholesterol, bad cholesterol. It's a lot easier just to say cholesterol. When you're talking about unemployment, there's some kinds of unemployment that are actually really good. If you have employees that you're paying a lot for that are not doing anything productive for your company, that's the kind of unemployment you need in the economy. You need to pull people out of the economy that are actually draining money rather than contributing.
There you go, talking about civil service employees again.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Or
not all of them.
And we have to look at, I just gave gushing praise to these boffins in the bureaucrats that if you look at what is the actual impact of their stuff, did they make anybody a profit by asking how much the cost of living increase should be for Social Security? No, it cost the government money, but we kind of want them to stay there and have a job. So when I'm saying good employment, bad employment, how do you make that decision when you're looking at a big bucket full of averaged together stuff? And the reality is you really have to dig deeper than the bucket. And I'm going to mix all the metaphors. So dig deeper than the bucket as it's being aggregated in with hot water and dry ice and all that good stuff. Yeah.
Speaking of that, it's time for us to do commercials.
Yes, it is. So if you would like to join the conversation, Philip has sent us a bunch of emails today. Roger sent us some. Philip has some hopefuls that we'll talk about stuff like what happened at the World Economic Forum in Davos. And he's encouraging us to be nice to each other as well, which is nice. He also gave us a lot of pressure to make this a good program. I'm not sure that we've accomplished that. We are economists. And therefore, when we are not speaking in a monotone, we believe we are exciting.
But on the other hand.
So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. Jeff at tpwc.com and Jake at tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa, Whiskey Charlie, or the personal wealth coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important messages. back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
And you have something to say. I can tell immediately. Go ahead.
Okay. Then let's talk about the big picture the last 10 minutes here for just a little bit. Lawrence Summers, who used to be Secretary of the Treasury and is considered to be a pretty deep thinker when it comes to the big picture global economy, made a statement that on Bloomberg TV, no less, that things have changed. And I happen to agree with him tremendously. There is a, we talked about this at the beginning of the program, but there's a fundamental shift has occurred in the global economy and in the U.S. economy. And it's probably a good idea to pay attention to it. There's a lot of, certainly an assumption that we can measure in the bond market right now that investors and bond traders are expecting very, very low interest rates to return in the near future. Probably not going to happen. They're expecting, because they're expecting inflation to descend and stay down like it was before the pandemic. Probably not going to happen. It's going to come down, but the Fed, instead of working hard as they did for the decade before the pandemic to try to raise inflation rates a little bit, is going to be faced with the issue of trying to hold them down. Why? There was a major event occurred that has been going on for a long time now, decades, and that is the entrance of China, started with Richard Nixon, which tells you how long ago it was, the entrance of the Asian worker into the global economic market, coming off of the farm behind an ox and providing very, 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 very low wages and low-cost manufacturing. It's run its course. The standard of living in China and India, by the way, India is about to pass China, or maybe we've already passed probably, China. It's the largest nation.
Yeah, as far as population.
Their standard of living is going up. Their cost of living is going up. And as a result, the cheap labor is disappearing. And we've actually seen that start to happen. So this period of time that we had following the end of the Cold War, when huge chunks of the world suddenly came into the labor market and we could manufacture things very, very inexpensively, is over. And by the way, that also happened 100 years ago. And as a result of that, we're going to see a very different economy in the 2020s moving forward and into the 2030s, a very, very different economy. Interest rates are going to be higher. Inflation is going to be steaming at the bit or whatever, frothing at the bit to move forward.
Steaming at the bit. I like the mixed metaphor. You have touched a nice spot in my heart with that one. That was nice.
The Fed is going to be fighting inflation rather than trying to encourage inflation. So we're not going to see the ultra low interest rates we got used to. They're going to see higher normal interest rates, long-term history. 10-year treasury yields, which we consider to be high right now. We've talked about how high they are. They're 120% of what they were 2 years ago. And they're so high, and it's the long-term average over the past three decades of the 10-year treasury yield was 3.89%. And we'll probably come back to that. It's called reversion to the mean. And so just get used to the fact that if you bought bonds in the past 10 or 15 years, they're going to be worth less today and into the future than they were when you bought them. That is a high probability, according to Lawrence Summers, and I happen to agree with him. We are seeing a major shift in the world economy. Like I said, we're going to see inflation figures start to pick up. We're going to see shifts that we probably don't even anticipate at this point. But it's a good idea to keep our eyes and ears open and make no assumptions that the recent past is the future, because it's just not true. Interest rates will probably rise through this decade. They're going to go up and down and up and down. Yeah, they're going to come up to around, like I said, if you use the treasury, come up to around 4%, maybe run up to a little above 5%, and then come back down to 4%. But they're not going to be back down to 2% for a long, long time. That means that the price of housing sales have fallen more in 2022. Actually, December had the fourth quarter had the largest decline in housing sales in percentage terms that we've seen since we've been keeping records. It's only a matter of time till the price of those houses start to come down too. They've come down a little bit, about 3.7% average nationally, but they're almost certainly going to come down more in 2023. So the price of houses are going to come down. People are going to feel less wealthy. We're going to have to continue to plow forward doing some different things. But the important point I want to make, and John early and during the first hour sent us in his newspaper article one of the articles he sent us even mentioned this. The 60-40 portfolio of bonds that is considered to be the normal balanced portfolio and the safe place to have your money didn't work this year. Didn't work in 2022. In the last 12 months, it was really a bad idea. The article in the Wall Street Journal he sent us suggested that we look at other places to put money besides bonds as a balance to stocks. And we completely agree with that. The important thing to recognize, and I've said this again and again and again, but it's important. It's different and it takes analysis and it takes thought and it's going to take planning to move forward. Don't make the assumption that what worked over the last 40 years is going to continue to work, because that 40% of the bond portfolio was based on the assumption that interest rates will continue down forever, because over 40 years, they have been coming down. The next 10 years, at least, they're probably going to be going up. So it's a big difference that we've seen. And it's one of those things that we have to reckon with in the world today.
Awesome. Yeah. The world is changing, but it's changing to sort of what it's been before, too.
Yeah.
You can see the patterns. They exist. And if you're, you know, when we're talking about whether it's a speaker election or what's going on with the economy or invasions and border shifts or any of that, there's not really anything new in any of this. It's just new to us. And Jorge Santayana said it very well. Those who do not remember history are condemned to repeat it. And that's truer than I can possibly say. So one of the really good things that I have been able to give as therapy to clients, therapy is not something I ever thought I would be doing, was to take a bigger look at what's happening politically, a bigger look at what's happening economically. Look at it in terms of history rather than getting into not just the woods, but into the tiny little bushes on who's right politically. Because people do that no matter what time you are, people get lost in this argument and don't realize where we are in history and that you should expect arguments like this right now. We're changing. Historically, this kind of event politically and economically has led to spinoffs of additional parties politically in the United States. If you look at what was happening in 1860, and if you look at when you were talking about the last time we had this many votes for the Senate, votes for the Speaker, or you even look back 100 years ago into the 1920s when we had two votes for a Speaker. When a party is in power but can't make a decision in its own majority, it generally means should probably be two parties, and it's not acting like that right now. So these are just little behavior things that we see in history, and it's not like we didn't know that talking about the Republicans right now. But the Democrats have the same thing going on. Their center and their extreme end are just as fractured as the center and extreme end of the Republican Party. It really looks like we have four parties here, and the people on the extremes of both the left and the right pretty close together in a lot of stuff. So
I'll even make based on history, the probability is very high that the Republican Party will split this year and there will be a third party going into the next presidential election.
Now, based on history, you generally need a statesman to step forward, even if it's just a very braggadocio statesman to come forward and bring enough people out of the tent to make a new party. I mean, Andrew Jackson didn't win the nomination as his party, and that's why he formed the Democrat Party. It was a third party issue, and then the party that he was a part of is no longer a party. It's gone. It wasn't Andrew Jackson that did it, but it was one step on the road. So lots going on right now. We live in calamitous and interesting times, and it's really cool to open our eyes every once in a while and look around and say, people are going to be studying this stuff. The pandemic, what we did economically afterwards, what happened during the Great Recession. I was living in it, and I didn't realize that it was going to be so much material for study. So seeing all that, we talked about it during the pandemic and the lockdown, that there's more stuff happening right now to study than has been compacted into a short time period ever. So we're excited about the future. We're excited about, even if we have a recession, things are good. But if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we're out of time. You can talk to us. We give personalized fiduciary investment advice and portfolio management. You can call us locally at
254-947-1111
or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to the webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You'll find our radio programs going back a long ways, podcasts, newsletters. You can sign up for the newsletter. You can find the podcast wherever you find podcasts. You can contact us through the contact form or email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next week, thank you very much for listening. This has been The Personal Wealth Coach.